finish up our discussion about other possibilities for annihilation for WIMP dark matter, and then we'll start looking at how we can actually look for WIMPs. So if you remember in the last lecture, when we finished solving the Boltzmann equation, what we found was that the amount of some stable particle chi is determined by its annihilation cross-section. It's proportional to 1 over the annihilation process cross-section. And so this gave us some target cross-section from the observed dark matter relic abundance of 6 times 10 to the minus 26 centimeters cubed per second. We talked about what kinds of models can satisfy this condition. We need to have stability. We need to make sure that it doesn't interact too strongly. But we saw that this was consistent with a new weakly interacting particle with a mass in the 100 GeV to TeV scale. So this was weakly interacting massive particle dark matter. And this tended to predict that if m chi is in the, say, 100 GeV to 1 TeV range, then the coupling through which it's annihilating is comparable to, say, the Z coupling in the standard model. So this is sort of a nice coincidence. So at the end of the last lecture, we looked at possible exceptions to these predictions so that you can have WIMP dark matter but maybe change some of the coupling properties. One of the things that we found is that if you annihilate through an intermediate S-channel state, into fermions, then when this propagator goes on shell, the matrix element gets huge. And so you get this resonant enhancement of annihilation. And so this means that instead of having a large coupling, you can have a small coupling with a resonant enhancement. And this can also give you the same cross-section. Okay. So this is resonant WIMP dark matter. The second one that I just want to briefly mention is motivated by the fact that we were considering theories that have lots of new particles in them. And so if that's the case, then we have to consider something called co-annihilation. And co-annihilation comes from the realization that, remember, we had split the universe into two sectors. We had this parity symmetry, which could have an even or an odd charge. And all of the standard model particles were here, going from the top, Higgs, WZ, etc. There could also be heavier Z2 even particles. So for instance, in supersymmetry, you have new Higgs boson states. In the Z2 odd sector, we had a lightest odd particle, which was stable. But we can, in principle, have other unstable particles in the odd sector. And these other unstable particles can decay into the dark matter particle. So for instance, if we once again take the supersymmetric example, we have all these superpartners, and they can decay into the lightest superpartner, which is the dark matter. So for instance, if we have, say, a Dino lightest particle, which is the superpartner of the hypercharged gauge boson, then the fact that in the standard model we have a Q gauge interaction also implies the existence of a superpartner of the Q superpartner of the gauge boson. Okay. So the decays of this squark also contribute to the dark matter number density. And so in principle, what we need to do is we need to figure out all of the abundances of the Z2 odd particles. They're all going to freeze out. And what you're left with is the total dark matter abundance. And the reason why this is important is that we've so far only been considering annihilation processes that are like chi bar goes to something else. Okay? So in a supersymmetric theory, you can imagine the equivalent of this is that you have, say, dark matter particle, using this same vertex, goes to QQ bar. Okay. And so the naive expectation is if this is the only thing that's happening in the early universe, then these couplings have to be such that sigma v is equal to, you know, if this were Dirac, 6 times 10 to the minus 26 centimeters cubed per second. And Susie, this is Majorana, so it changes by an order one factor. But the point is that the self-annihilation process naively needs to be of this size. But as soon as we have extra particles in the theory, we also get extra annihilation modes. So for instance, I could also have this same vertex. And then I have one strongly interacting particle. I can have another strongly interacting particle. And these couple to, say, gluons. So what am I doing? So the point is that this process also depletes the number density of these Bs, except instead of having a electromagnetic coupling, we have a strong coupling. You don't need to know any of these details except just to see that as soon as we start adding more particles into the theory, you're adding in more annihilation channels, and you're adding in more things that contribute to the dark matter density through decays. And so what you need to do is you need to separately track all of these abundances, and the sum total is going to be your dark matter distribution. Okay. So notice that this diagram, okay, so what we're claiming is that, say, this is a strong coupling and this is a weak coupling. This process is going to be much bigger by the strong coupling squared. Yes.
So having these extra diagrams, does it change the value of the
Well, I would say that they're different sigma v. So this is sigma bb, and this is sigma b squared. No. What you need is sort of the sum of them to be the thermal value in some
right,
rough sense. That's right, yeah.
The sum of them will have to be 6
yeah.
times.
That's right. So remember, this is a cosmological number, right? So this comes from the getting the right dark matter density. How that maps onto the specific particle physics properties, what this is illustrating is that it's not just a linear mapping. Is that when you have extra particles, suddenly, you know, you can have resonances which change the coupling expectation. You can also add new particles which also change the coupling expectation. Yeah. So, good. Okay. So this process. This rate goes like n of these squarks times sigma v. This one goes like n of b times sigma b, 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 sigma b squark. So you can see that there's a trade-off here where maybe this diagram is bigger because you have a strong coupling, but maybe there are fewer of these squarks around because they're heavier. So in general, it's a very complicated problem to solve. Because this number density goes like e to the minus m squark over t, and this one goes to like e to the minus m dark matter over t, the ratio of these is exponentially suppressed in the mass. Okay. So if I make this squark even a little bit heavier, like let's say this is 200 GeV and this is 250 GeV, it's probably completely negligible, okay, because you get some big exponential suppression. But when they're very degenerate, then you find that these processes can win out over the naive ones. Okay. So what you have to do in this scenario is that you have to define an effective n chi, which is the sum over all of the z2 odd particles. So you add all of them up, and then you have some big coupled differential equation, which looks almost exactly the same as what we had before. Except now I'm going to have an annihilation cross-section of particle I with particle j. And then I'm going to have ni nj minus ni equilibrium. NJ equilibrium. So, I mean, just to write it down, it's a very simple extension of the Boltzmann equation that we had before, which was just this, except I is always equal to J. And we're not going to solve it for this coupled case because it's quite confusing, but you can kind of see that adding in these extra particles can both produce more dark matter by having more decays, and also less dark matter by having more annihilations. And so, for instance, in if you're doing model building within, or dark matter model building within a very particular framework like supersymmetry or something, you have to take into account all of these effects, because as soon as you have particles that are very close in mass with the dark matter particle, then all of these effects start popping up. Now, from a sort of naturalness perspective, you might not like these mechanisms because they seem to rely on accidental having other things close to the dark matter that either enhance or suppress the annihilation rate. And that's true, but this could also just be the way that the world is. So we have to understand that. Okay, so are there any questions about co-annihilation?
So, I mean, if you believe in supersymmetry, then it's probably inescapable that there are particles. It's maybe it doesn't seem unnatural that to me that there would be particles whose masses would be close to the dark matter.
That's true. I mean, for the resonant one to work, the masses have to be really close to dark matter mass. The reason being that the width of these particles is often fairly small. But you're right that there are so many new particles that often you just accidentally end up with ones that are close together. So it's not unreasonable to expect this. Yeah. But it does, I would say that it's sort of a little asterisk next to the WIMP miracle, because it's saying that the WIMP miracle doesn't quite get us the right answer with just a naive annihilation, but when you sum together everything, it works out, which could be the way it works. Any other questions?
Yes. You just said that the naive WIMP miracle doesn't work, and that's because of experimental lack of experimental evidence.
Well, so okay. The first thing that I should clarify is that before we start worrying about getting the right annihilation cross-section, we should first discover other particles that are associated with supersymmetry, for instance. Okay. So the fact that we haven't seen anything means that you're right, we don't actually understand anything about the sector. These methods are more saying that in light of existing experimental constraints on supersymmetry, it's hard to make certain dark matter candidates work in supersymmetry. And so then you need to invoke these mechanisms, because the annihilation cross-section just comes out to be too small and you end up with too much dark matter. Okay. And I should point out that while so far we're talking about adding these particles to give us dark matter, we can also treat this as a constraint, which is that even if I don't want to explain dark matter, my theory certainly shouldn't give me too much dark matter. So that's a problem that a lot of supersymmetric theories are facing, is that without having these mechanisms, you can end up with just too much dark matter. And that's bad, even if you don't want it to explain dark matter. So these kinds of things can reduce the abundance of dark matter by raising the effect of annihilation cross-section. Any other questions? Okay, so the topic for this week is going to be focusing on the detection of WIMP dark matter. And so the goal of this is to use the fact that WIMPs, basically up to the conversations that we have an annihilation cross-section that's this magic number that we've been working with. So we know that it has to have, if this framework is correct, it suggests that there is a dark matter Sanner model coupling comparable to the electroweak interaction. And the reason why this is exciting from an experimental perspective is that we have a lot of evidence for electroweak interactions. So for instance, at colliders, we can just directly produce the W and Z bosons. As of 2012, we actually produced the Higgs bosons as well. And so we can see things that are pretty heavy and pretty weakly coupled to the standard model. And so if you think the dark matter and the standard model have sort of comparable couplings in this range, then maybe we can see dark matter too. Okay. So the general picture that is often drawn is this. So we'll draw the thermal freeze-out diagram. And here I'm just going to make it ambiguous about what's actually doing the annihilation. And we see that the process as it proceeds in this way sets the relic abundance. But this is a Feynman diagram. We can use it to compute matrix elements. And we know that there's this thing called crossing symmetry, which is that if I rotate this diagram or change which are the initial and the final states, the Feynman rules don't actually change. And so I end up with a matrix element, at least, which looks the same as before. So I can also consider all of the other possible directions of this diagram. So for instance, if I treat time moving in the down direction, then I have a chi particle, which comes in, scatters off a standard model particle, and then both of them exit. Okay. So this is chi standard model scattering. And this is going to lead to a class of experiments that we'll call direct detection experiments, where basically we use the fact that we're in this bath of dark matter particles, and so you can put a lump of matter somewhere and you can look for dark matter to come in and scatter off of it. So this is chi F to chi F, essentially. Another possibility is we can look in the same direction, chi chi bar to FF bar, and say that, if we know that in the early universe the dark matter can annihilate, then dark matter can also annihilate today. So dark matter is clumped in these halos, and so we can look for evidence of dark matter annihilating into standard model particles nowadays. This is called indirect dark matter detection. So the reason why this is direct is because you can literally see the dark matter particles scatter in your detector. The reason why this is indirect detection is that what you're looking for is these annihilation products, and you're inferring the existence of dark matter from them. Finally, we can also go in the opposite direction and say, take two standard model particles and annihilate them into chi chi bar. And this is what we do at, say, particle colliders, where, for instance, if these initial state particles are quarks, then we can collide protons together and produce dark matter at the LHC or at any other high energy collider. And so this is another way that you can probe this diagram. And in the ideal thing that we would like is if we see dark matter signals in one of these channels to try and look for dark matter in other ones, you can kind of correlate the results. And then we get a very strong picture about what dark matter is doing.
So what was the last thing called?
Dark matter at colliders. So, yeah. Yes. No, so as of right now, there are no definitive detections of dark matter in any channel other than gravitationally. Okay, I will say that there are anomalies in all of these channels that could be from dark matter, but as we'll see, all of these are quite difficult to do. So for instance, for direct detection, you're looking for a very rare process, and there's a lot of thermal noise and radioactive stuff that can mimic a dark matter particle. For the indirect detection, there's a lot of astrophysical processes, which also can give rise to energetic final states, and so there's a lot of ambiguity there. And at colliders, the main challenge is that dark matter is basically invisible. So if you produce it, you don't actually see it. So you have to infer its existence some other way. Yes? Pardon me? Yeah, there are a lot of anomalies that come and go. There are a few, and I mean, I'll talk about them when I talk about each of these, but there's some that claim to be 10 sigma detection of dark matter, but they're also excluded by about 5 orders of magnitude and rate by other experiments. So the current status is that no one really believes 100% that any of these things are true. Oh, I should say, some people believe 100% that their anomalies are true, but the community in general is very conservative on this picture, because the last thing that we want to do is announce the discovery of dark matter and then find out that it was just a fake. You know, remember the faster than speed of light neutrinos? I don't know if any of you remember this, but yeah. Okay, so this is an example of what happens when there's a problem. People go nuts about these kinds of things. So I should say that there is controversy in the community about whether we should say that we have discovered dark matter, because we've now seen dark matter indirectly in a huge number of channels. So some people think, we shouldn't wait until we see evidence like this to start handing out Nobel Prizes. So this is more just to test the particle properties of dark matter, but we're pretty confident that dark matter is there. That's a good question.
So is there any new hope with the restart of LHC
this year? Sure, yeah. So the LHC is going to accumulate a lot more data. It's at a higher energy, and in the next lecture or two, we'll talk about the LHC. Yeah. Certainly, there have been a lot of news articles about dark matter lately, and I think part of that is because, you know, the media wants something new and exciting, and so if you just say, "Oh, we're going to test the Higgs boson some more," they're like, "Well, that's really boring. You know, you've already seen it." So they want to know about dark matter and extra dimensions and things like that, okay. And black holes. Okay, so today we're going to talk about indirect detection. And we'll start with that one because it has the most connection with thermal freeze-out that we've done already. Namely that it's literally the same process that gives you indirect detection and also sets the relic abundance. So in some ways, this is one of the more difficult ones to get around, so to speak, just because if this was annihilating the early universe, it has to be annihilating on some level today. Now you can ask, well, our whole premise was that dark matter is freezing out, and so its annihilation stop and its number density gets fixed. So hasn't dark matter frozen out? And the answer, of course, is yes. But this is talking about cosmological scales. So this means that if you look at how the number density of dark matter is depleted by annihilations, it's very, very small relative to the total number. And so you could wait many, many ages of the universe and you'd still have lots of dark matter. But that doesn't mean that some dark matter isn't annihilating. It just means that the rate is much, much less than Hubble. So even though gamma is much, much less than H, gamma is still not of, say, chi-chi annihilation. It's still not zero. And so we can still look for the very rare annihilation processes. Okay. So that is one motivation. The other thing is that dark matter is more clumpy today than, say, at the CMB time. So what this means is that there are specific places in the universe that we know dark matter is, and so we can point our telescopes at them, as opposed to trying to look for some very small homogeneous signal that's coming. Okay, that would in some sense be harder to find, but what we want to do is we want to correlate the signs of dark matter annihilation with where dark matter actually is. And this is what makes indirect detection a reasonable prospect. So the topics for this, which we'll probably go into tomorrow as well, is we need to talk a little bit about dark matter halos. The reason is that we need to know where we should look and what we should expect. So then we'll talk a little bit about the formalism. So basically how we map the particle physics parameters of dark matter into a signal that we see. So then we'll talk mostly about a single example, which is dark matter annihilation in gamma rays. And the reason why we'll talk about this is that it's the cleanest signature in some ways and is probably the best prospect for detection. And then other possibilities for indirect detection. Okay. So there are, we look at halos. There are two very good places to look for dark matter. And what's nice about these is that they're both regions of high dark matter density, but they're somewhat different with respect to one another. Okay. So the first one is the galactic center of either the Milky Way or of other galaxies or of other galaxy clusters. And the reason there is obvious is just that galaxies are enormous objects, and so all of the dark matter tends to clump in the middle, and so we can look in the middle. And basically what the setup looks like is that we have the galactic disk, and we're sitting out on the disk at a distance of some 8 kiloparsecs. This, just for a sense of scale, is about 20. So we're sort of in a typical place in the middle of the galactic disk. So let's say this is the Milky Way. The dark matter halo actually forms a giant spherical mass. So this is what the dark matter halo looks like. And the reason is that dark matter doesn't have self-interactions in the minimal model, and so it doesn't dissipate energy. So it doesn't collapse into a disk. It just stays in a large halo. Now, the problem with this is that we have ways of guessing what the dark matter halo looks like, but we don't actually know exactly what the dark matter halo looks like. So what we have to do is we have to do n-body simulations. And n-body simulations are basically, you take a lot of dark matter particles, you let them not interact at all, and you put, say, initial conditions that look like small perturbations in a uniform number density, and then you just let them collapse under the effect of gravity. Okay? And then you do this a gazillion times, and you study the properties of how they form, okay, into halos. So, you know, there are various ways you can do this. You can talk about large-scale structure of the universe, the sort of filaments and things that form the big structure of the universe. You can also do it on galactic scales. And what's found is that there are a few numerically motivated functions that tend to describe the dark matter density. But obviously, usually there are free parameters in these models just because we don't actually know very well what the dark matter number density is. And this is going to turn out to be a major uncertainty associated with indirect detection, which is that we need to convince ourselves that this is a correct description of what the dark matter number density is like. So as an example, which is often used, there's something called the Navarro-Frank-White profile, or NFW profile. And it has the form that the dark matter number density is spherically symmetric, so it's a function just of the radius. And so there's some overall normalization. There's some characteristic radius, which is usually about 20 kiloparsecs. So this is about the size of the disk, say. To the minus gamma, 1 plus r over r sub s to the 3 minus gamma. And then the canonical example, gamma is 1. And what you see is that the dark matter profile has this sort of break in it, where if you are at radii that's large relative to this r sub s, then it goes like r to the minus 3, or to the 3 minus 2 gamma. And then at shorter radii, it just has a 1 over r kind of dependence. So this is sort of a very steeply cussed, and then there's some break here. Okay? And then there's a 1 over r cubed. And this is what I was mentioning in the first lecture, that it turns out that this actually also explains the flat rotation curves that are observed. So often what's done is several different profiles that are considered very different are considered, and they're used to kind of set our uncertainties on what the signal should look like. But they all kind of look like this. So this is what the galactic center is. It has some advantages. So the advantages are that there's a huge dark matter mass. So this is good. The disadvantage is that there's large baryon mass as well. And at the end of the day, astrophysics is not 100% well understood science in terms of various objects. So for instance, there are pulsars and objects that can give off very high energy cosmic rays. And if we want to claim that we're seeing dark matter, we have to convince ourselves that what we're seeing isn't just baryons. Okay? So there's a trade-off here, which is that there's a huge signal, but there's a small signal to background rate. Okay? So you might expect to see a signal here first, but you might also expect not to believe the signal when you see it. The second place that we can look are called dwarf spheroidal galaxies. And dwarf spheroidal galaxies are basically like subhalos of larger galaxies. So if we have the Milky Way, sitting here, and we have this large dark matter halo. It's not completely uniformly distributed, but you got little subhalos. And what's key about dwarfs is that they're dark matter dominated, which means that unlike the Milky Way, which when you're in the middle, there's more baryons than dark matter, with dwarfs, there's basically always more dark matter. And so, for instance, we can use the visible matter as a dark matter tracer. So for instance, you can infer how much dark matter there is by looking at the motion of the baryons, and because the baryons are so small compared to the total mass, you basically know what the dark matter number density in that region is. Now, the advantages of this are high signal to noise, because we have so much more dark matter than baryon stuff. We don't expect huge numbers of stars, and so we don't expect the same kinds of energetic processes that we have in the galactic center. The disadvantages are low signal. At the end of the day, these are minor perturbations on the whole galaxy, and we actually don't know of the existence of too many dwarfs. So there was recently, just a month or two ago, the announcement that the Dark Energy Survey has discovered something like 8 new dwarf galaxies, whereas before they knew of the existence of, say, 18. So this is a huge increase, a factor of 50% in the number of dwarfs, and so this is really exciting from the perspective of dark matter searches, because we've basically just put a huge boost to our possible signal statistics when you look at dwarf galaxies. Yeah, for the Milky Way. So it's a small number. Yeah.
So dwarf galaxies are in the Milky Way?
At dwarf spheroidal, yeah, or associated with the Milky Way. I shouldn't say it's like in, but yeah. They are gravitationally bound to larger galaxies. So the hope is that if you see a signal in both of these and you can correlate the rates, then that's a really strong signature, because you expect the cosmic ray behavior in dwarfs and in the galactic center to be very different. Okay. So that's sort of the holy grail, is a detection in both of these things. Okay, and then just the definition of what our sky looks like, or I should say the Milky Way in our sky. Often it's written in galactic coordinates, where the galactic center is at the middle. This direction is called B. This direction is called L, and usually it's given an angular coordinate. Okay, so B equals 0 is the disk. Okay, B equals plus or minus 90 are the poles of the galaxy, so the top and bottom parts from our perspective. L equals 0 means that we're looking towards the galactic center, and plus or minus 90 means away from the galactic center. So anytime any data is released for observations of the galaxy, the data is always mapped onto this picture, so that we can do cross comparisons of them. Okay, are there any questions about dark matter halos or where we can look for dark matter in the galaxy? Yes.
Are there clumps of dark matter by itself? So no visible.
Well, so for instance, the bullet cluster that I mentioned, where you have two colliding galaxy clusters, there the visible matter has essentially been completely stripped away from the dark matter. Okay. The problem is that these galaxy clusters are extremely far away, and so the flux is hugely diluted by the time that it reaches us. So there was a paper recently actually that proposed looking at colliding galaxy clusters, but typically you needed to have huge dark matter density. So for WIMPs, it's not very useful, but for other kinds of dark matter candidates, you can maybe see them there. And I mean, dwarfs are sufficiently dark matter dominated that they're more reliable. Although the story with indirect detection is that people always say, oh, if we see dark matter here, it's a very clean signature. And then someone sees a signal there and everyone says, we don't believe it. So, so we'll wait and see. Maybe if we see it in dwarfs, we'll actually believe it, but maybe not. Okay. It's just in spherical coordinates, basically. When we're sitting here, it's a projection of the galaxy onto a spherical coordinate system. So this is b equals zero, this is l equals zero, and then you've kind of unwrapped the rest of it onto that picture. Any other questions? Okay, so now we can look at the formalism. Okay, so what we do practically is you take a telescope and you point it in some direction n hat, and you accumulate some quantity of cosmic rays or photons or whatever coming from that direction, and then you just count. And then you can do that for conceivably multiple different directions, but we'll write the formula just for an individual one, and then you can integrate over the different directions. Okay. So now what happens when I point my telescope in a particular direction is that I'm seeing every cosmic ray that comes from infinity, essentially, or the particle horizon, all the way to my telescope. And so this includes all of the dark matter, not just in the Milky Way, but in whatever galaxies happen to be behind the Milky Way and out. Now, practically speaking, because the Milky Way is right, we're in the middle of it, and there's a huge dark matter halo that's surrounding us, almost all of the annihilation will come from us. But technically, what you have to do is integrate over everything. So this is called a line of sight integral. And this is just the reality of indirect detection. Is that you can't, there's some depth information maybe from redshift, but of course if we don't know what energies we're supposed to be looking for, then we don't necessarily know how much something was redshifted. So we just have to take everything. So what we basically do is we point our telescope and we do a line of sight integral over all the dark matter between infinity and here. So what this allows us to do is define a flux. So this is basically a rate of particle in telescope, hitting telescope, per area, per energy. So we want both how much is coming in, and we want to know the spectrum of what energy the distribution the source has. Somewhat confusingly, this is often just called phi itself, which is a function of the energy and the direction. So you take this, if you want an actual rate, you integrate it over the physical area of the telescope, and you integrate it over the energy resolution, or the energies that are in the acceptance. What is this? This is equal to sigma v over 8 pi m chi squared times some function of energy. Then we do this integral over the line of sight, dl rho chi squared of l. So this is sort of the master formula. So let me explain what this is. This is the fraction of annihilation products with energy E. So for instance, if I'm looking at photons, then what I can do is just compute my dark matter annihilation into photons. There's going to be some distribution from the cross-section. And then I can just turn this into a probability function for that process. And there's going to be one for electrons and one for protons and all the stable particles that can reach us. Okay. This rho chi comes about because annihilation is going to be proportional to the number density of the particle squared, because we want two particles colliding in a volume. And we can write the number density as rho over m. So what this does is it allows us to express all of these things in terms of the cross-section, the mass, the energy density, which is something that is sort of suggested from cosmological observations, and how energetic the final state particles are. And often what's done is that these things are actually separated into a particle physics part . So the particle physics part is often denoted Q. And this is at our local position. So this is defined as 1/2 the rho of dark matter at our local position, where m chi squared, sigma v, fi of e. Okay. And this mostly depends on the annihilation cross-section, the mass, the energy, and then there's some normalization that is proportional to the local dark matter density. But these are all things that are relatively well understood. So if I propose a theory of dark matter, I can basically tell the astrophysicist, okay, here's my Q factor. So this is some input that tells them what, the from the particle physics side, the cosmic ray spectrum will look like. So then what we have to do is we have to combine it with the astrophysics part, which is called a J factor. And the J factor includes the line of sight integral. And it's a dimensionless quantity. Okay, so this takes into account all of the possible sources of dark matter that you can have. And then the flux is just some combination of these objects. And what's convenient is it allows astrophysicists to go and measure very specific things. And then particle physicists can propose various models and tell the Q factor. And then you can interpret, you know, combine this information into a constraint on, you can take a constraint on the flux and using the J factor convert it into a constraint on the particle physics parameters. Yes,
to both.
Oh, sorry, this is a 4 pi. So it's 1/2 and then 4 pi. Yeah, sorry, that was my mistake. So for the J factors, you need to do n-body simulations and astrophysical observations. This, in principle, you should know how to calculate. Because this is just the momentum dependence of the cross-section, the differential cross-section. Okay, so in order to look for this, we need to know what dark matter can annihilate into. So far we've been fairly agnostic about what dark matter is annihilating into. We just assume that there's some blob and it goes to F bar, where F is some final state fermion, but it doesn't even have to be a fermion. So for instance, this can be a quark, can be a lepton, can be a gauge boson. And of course, these things are not necessarily stable final state particles, so the quarks will hadronize and they'll form protons and neutrons and pions. The W's and Z's will decay into leptons and quarks, and so on. Okay. So all of these are very important, but they give, for lack of a better word, like particle cosmic rays, like matter particle cosmic rays, like charged hadrons, charged leptons, these sorts of things. And these are a bit tricky because they interact with magnetic fields astrophysically. They scatter in various ways because they're fairly strongly interacting. And so they're generally quite complicated because they don't just depend on these unknown J factors, but they depend on things like how big the magnetic field is, which we don't really understand. If I have a charged particle, how does it diffuse out to us? We don't really have a 100% understanding of that. So while these are often the dominant ways the dark matter annihilates, they're often not the cleanest ways you can look for dark matter because the uncertainties in the propagation of these cosmic rays is much higher than it is for some other final states. So as a result, we're going to focus instead on gamma rays. Because the basic formalism from this perspective is exactly the same. It's just then you have to add in a stage of propagating the cosmic ray particles from the source to us. So are there any questions about this equation or what we're about to do? Okay. So gamma rays, of course, are just a fancy word for photons. So the naive expectation is that because dark matter is dark, you don't actually expect a large interaction rate with photons. So you can't have a tree-level interaction with photons, at least if dark matter has an electric charge above 10 to the minus 3 or so. Yes?
Sorry, just going back a little bit, when you produce Q, L, and W, and Z, I mean, we don't see those things anyway. Would they actually
here? Yeah, so they'll form, for instance, protons, antiprotons, electrons, positrons, and so on. So we'll see the decay products of those things, but of course, for instance, charged pions, they have a relatively long life because they're going to be produced with a very large boost typically. And so they can scatter off things and then their decay products will point in a different direction. And, you know, yeah. So you're right that we don't directly observe this, but for lack of a better word, they give rise to the visible final states that we see. And there's actually a lot of correspondence between this and like collider physics, where just like in colliders, when you produce final state FF bar, they hadronize and decay and whatnot. Okay, so mapping this onto the decay products can be as well understood from colliders. Okay, so dark matter it doesn't have a tree level interactor with photons, but it interacts, if you believe in the WIMP story, with non-dark stuff. And because we're doing quantum mechanics and not classical mechanics, it's going to induce higher order couplings to photons. So for instance, if I have chi chi bar to some charged particle, F plus F minus, then I can also have chi chi bar to gamma gamma, if I just close these fermions in a loop and I emit two photons. So my rate is going to be loop suppressed, so it's some alpha over 4 pi suppression of the rate, or 4 pi squared, but if the gamma signal is so much cleaner than the cosmic rays, then it might be worth taking this hit, for instance. Okay. So this is what we'll call primary production of photons, because we're having dark matter annihilating into photons. And I should say that the E of the gamma is about the mass of chi. Because if this particle is non-relativistic, the center of mass energy is 2m chi. And so the final center of mass energy in the final state is also going to be 2m chi. So the energy of the photon is linked to the dark matter mass. Okay. But there are other ways you can produce it. So for instance, we can have chi chi bar annihilate into QQ bar. And then we'll talk about this more in the collider section, but what happens is that because these are strongly interacting, they don't exist as free quarks, okay? Because the energy associated with the color field that exists between these objects becomes bigger than the mass of a QQ bar pair. And so what happens is QQ bar pairs get popped out of the vacuum to form color singlets. And so there's sort of a shower of final states of QQ bars. Okay. And then these, some QQ bar pair, will form, for instance, pions, rho mesons, and three quarks will form protons and neutrons, and three antiquarks will form antiprotons and antineutrons, essentially. Okay. So this is what happens when we produce quarks. And in particular, I'm not sure if you covered this in your standard model class, but the pi zero can decay into gamma gamma through loops of charged, say, protons running in this loop. So what happens is I produce energetic pions in the final state, and then the pions decay into photons. So I get indirectly photons from this. So this is called secondary production. This is a dominant mechanism, but you can also produce photons just by radiating off photons from the final state lines. Okay? And both of these things give rise to secondary photons. The reason why they're called secondary is that the photons originate from the particle decays, or it's not directly linked to the chi mass. These are things that are only picking up a fraction of the chi energy. And then the last one is a process where if I produce charged particles in the final state, so I have some charged particle, it then propagates through the galaxy. It's typically much more energetic than anything else in the galaxy because dark matter has a huge mass, a GeV scale energy. And it can scatter off of starlight or lower energy photons. And it can upscatter the photons. So this is a low energy photon, and this is a high energy photon. Okay. And this is called inverse Compton scattering. Okay. And so if we plot what these spectra look like, so F gamma is a function of E, then typically what you get is something like a big peak at M chi. So this is the primary signal that you're trying to look for. I should say that this is normalized to 1, so I'm not trying to show that this is what the distribution would actually look like, but this is the shape of the chi directly annihilating into photons. Then the secondary photons form a continuum. Okay. Well, in this case, if it's from chi annihilation, they should cut off around the chi mass. But the point is that there's no specific feature. And then for the inverse Compton scattering, there's sort of a turn on and a turn off. So this is secondary. This is inverse Compton scattering. And so what we want to do is measure the spectrum of the photons that are hitting the detector and look for this bump, essentially. Or look for an excess on this tail. This is obviously, once again, a cleaner signature, but this is loop suppressed and electromagnetically suppressed. So this rate is typically the smallest of all of these things. These are quite big because neutral pions decay to gammas 100% of the time. And a lot of the energy goes into neutral pions. So some order one fraction of the dark matter energy is in a typical annihilation to QQ bar is going to go into photons. So if we actually plot the number density, this curve is going to be way up here. So if we have a very sensitive detector, we can pick out this bump, and that's the ideal thing that we want to see. But often the constraints that you can get from these secondary photons are stronger. So this is another example of this has high signal rate, but a low signal-to-noise rate because it looks a lot like the gamma ray emission from the galaxy, which has no features. This has a feature, so it has a high signal-to-noise rate, but the rate is very small. Since we're out of time, tomorrow we'll look at what the actual constraints are. As I mentioned, we don't have any definitive proof of dark matter annihilation in direct detection, so I'll first show the constraints. And then I'll talk about an anomaly, which is currently a hot topic, which is the observation of an excess in GeV energy gamma rays from the galactic center. So right now, it's pretty much established that this excess is there over the naive expectation. The question is whether it's dark matter or if it's some astrophysical origin. So we'll talk about that tomorrow. Are there any questions about the production mechanisms before we go? Great.